I'm extremely happy to be here at PI and also to be giving a talk at Strings 2023. About a year and a half ago, my colleague Asiminar Vanitaki and I decided to take a break away from speculative model building, theories that involve new particles or new forces or new dimensions, and work on something that actually is known to exist. This was a first for Mina, and it was just a second for me, even though I have a very long career. It was the second time I'm thinking about things that actually exist. The first time was 15 years ago in 2008, when I proposed an atom interferometric gravitational wave detector that is in fact now being built at Fermilab as well as in Europe. So I hope what I'm going to talk about today will have a similar fate and it will inspire experiments. So the topic is the cosmic neutrino background, and my talk will have three parts. First, I'll review what the cosmic neutrino background is. Then I'll talk about what happens to it when it approaches the surface of the Earth. And finally, I'll talk about how we may manipulate its density in such a way to potentially make it more observable. So first, a review of what's the cosmic neutrino background. The cosmic neutrino background, as you know, everybody in the room knows, we start with a very hot universe where everything, just about every particle of the standard model, except for the graviton, are in thermal equilibrium. And then the universe expands, that gets diluted, and various reactions stop happening because of the dilution of the density of the universe. The first things that stop interacting are, of course, the gravitons, because they are by far the most weakly interacting particles. Second among those, the particles of the standard model, are the neutrinos, which have very weak interactions, and they decouple, or they stop interacting with their environment when the electron-positron annihilation happens. At a temperature of the order of the electron mass, E plus E minus annihilate, and the neutrinos essentially lose their main partner with which they were colliding, and that decouples them. This happens, as I said, when the temperature is about an MeV and the time is a fraction of a second. From that time, these cosmic neutrinos, until today, they've been traveling freely in the universe, just falling in the gravitational field of the universe. And the only non-trivial thing they've been doing is they've been expanding their wavelength in proportion to the size of the universe. So originally, their wavelength, their energy was an MeV. Today, their energy turns out to be about 10 orders of magnitude smaller, 10 minus 4 eV. 10 orders of magnitude is the degree to which the universe expanded since then. That corresponds to a temperature of about a degree. Their momentum is also about 10 minus 4 eV. The density distribution is a Fermi-Dirac distribution corresponding to massless particles. This is in spite of the fact the neutrinos are actually extremely non-relativistic today. Their mass is about 0.1 eV. Nevertheless, their momentum is much smaller. And even though they are non-relativistic, they obey the relativistic Fermi-Dirac distribution, because nothing, no interactions change their distribution. The only thing that has been happening is that temperature has been redshifting. The number density is about 50 particles per cubic centimeter per helicity. So this means that if you take a square centimeter, there is about 10 billion neutrinos crossing it every second. So they have a pretty good large flux, and this might suggest that we should be no problem with such a flux to observe it. As we'll see, this is not quite the case. The standard model expectation for the neutrino and antineutrino asymmetry is that it is similar to the baryon asymmetry. This is both suggested in grand unified theories and also is a dynamical consequence in simplest scenarios of having some objects called sphalerons that around the weak scale tend to equilibrate baryon number and lepton number. So we expect the abundance to be about 10 to minus, a few times 10 to minus 9. The fractional abundance, the fractional excess of neutrinos minus antineutrinos to be about 10 to minus 9. Why are they important? The analogy here is the cosmic microwave background radiation. So here is a history of the universe. When the universe was 380,000 years old, the photons decoupled from the universe. They decouple much later than neutrinos because they have stronger interactions. And since then, the photons, these primordial photons, have been traveling freely, and we've been observing them for three decades and learning about the state of the universe around when it was 380,000 years old. So the hope is that we can, if we manage to detect the cosmic neutrino background, we may be able to do something analogous and find out directly about the state of the universe when it was less than a second old. So there is a number of interesting things about cosmic neutrinos that I'm listing here. The first is what I just said. The second is that the neutrinos form, they are not very well studied. We know quite a few things about them, but we don't know in any detail. So it's a whole sector of the standard model. It has three flavors. In the minimum case, there is three flavors and seven mixing angles. And if the sector is any richer, there is many more things to be learned about it. They turn out to be the most abundant species, standard model species of the universe, together with the photons. So both have somewhat accidentally comparable abundances. The cosmic neutrinos are the only non-relativistic neutrinos that we have in the universe. Most neutrinos are produced either by nuclear decays, which have energies of the order MeVs, or at least tens of keVs, or they produce in violent astrophysical processes. For that reason, all the neutrinos produced in the late universe are ultra-relativistic. This means that they consist predominantly of their left-handed component, and they have very little right-handed mixture. The right-handed mixture is proportional to the mass over the energy, which is a tiny number. So this means that they are a good laboratory, probably the best laboratory, for studying whether neutrinos are Dirac or Majorana. And there are significant differences in how they behave when the neutrinos are non-relativistic. When they are relativistic, they are probably predominantly left-handed because that's what the weak interaction produces. And that's what the last item says. So if you want to study the physics of the right-handed neutrinos, which could be very rich, it could be a portal or a bridge to some new sector that the right-handed neutrino is the communicator, the messenger of, and that we cannot study at present because there are very few right-handed neutrinos in the universe, in the late universe produced by ordinary late processes. So these are a few of the reasons why it's important. For at least 60 years, probably more by now, people have been trying to think of ways to detect them, and there are heroic proposals on trying to do that. And the main reason why it's hard to do is that the Fermi coupling is a small number, and the mass scales for cosmic neutrinos are very small. Their mass is 0.1 eV. Their energy is 10 to minus 6 eV. Momentum is small. So typically, the scattering rates depend on the product of the square of G Fermi times the characteristic phase space or mass scale of the problem. Tiny number, you get cross sections like 10 to minus 50 some centimeters squared, typically. And there are some effects that are linear in G Fermi. These also turn out to be very small. One effect is that if you have a net neutrino number, then the neutrino current acts like a magnetic field around which electron spins precess. And so one could look for a precession of electric field of an electron spin in space. It turns out that the precession rate is extremely small. It's like 10 to the minus 14 times longer. The period is 10 to 14 times longer than the age of the universe. That corresponds to this 10 to the minus 47 energy. And the smallest measured energies in the lab are far, far bigger than that. So these linear effects are not going to be important for what I'm going to talk about, but they were historically some of the first proposals for looking for neutrinos. What we decided to look at to start with is the forces of the cosmic neutrino background on macroscopic matter, on a chunk of matter, typically centimeter-sized matter, for example. And to figure out what that interaction is, first we start with the Fermi, this 100-year-old Lagrangian for weak interactions. This is just the J0 is the density of neutrinos, J0 matter is the density of matter. So the product of densities times the Fermi coupling, that's the energy density associated with the interaction potential between neutrinos and matter. So this means if you have one atom, the interaction energy with the neutrino background is proportional to the density of the background times G Fermi times this Q, which is the charge of the weak charge of the atom. And this number turns out, in fact, this number turns out to be small. It's smaller than Hubble. It's smaller than Hubble for a single atom, but if you have Avogadro's number, then it gets a little better. Okay. Nevertheless, the starting point is the energy, the interaction energy per atom is tiny. It's less than Hubble. The same Fermi-Lagrangian implies that the potential energy of the potential that describes the interaction of a neutrino with ordinary matter is proportional to the density of matter times G Fermi times some very important coefficients that will play a role in what we are going to discuss. For example, this interaction potential turns out to be positive for electron neutrinos. Okay, this means electron neutrinos that are propagating freely in space, if they encounter matter, they will feel a positive potential, so they'll be repelled, or at least they'll be slowed down as they encounter matter. Repulsive force. The converse is true for electron-antineutrinos. Electron-antineutrinos feel an attractive force towards matter. And it turns out that the opposite happens for the muon and tau neutrinos. The force on muon and tau neutrinos is repulsive, and on muon and tau antineutrinos is attractive. Okay. From now on, I'll be using a language to abbreviate my sentences where I'll be referring to electron neutrinos or electron antineutrinos. But whatever I say for electron neutrinos will qualitatively be also correct for the muon and tau antineutrinos because they also feel the same repulsive force. Remember the interaction energy for an atom with the neutrino density is less than Hubble. In contrast, the interaction energy of a neutrino with matter, because matter is quite dense, is 10 to the minus 14 electron volts. It's still small, but it's not Hubble. So Hubble is 10 to the minus 33 electron volts, by the way. So that's the interaction energy. It's non-zero, nevertheless, it's small compared to the kinetic energy of the neutrinos, of the cosmic neutrinos, which is 10 to minus 6 eV. Okay. Now, what I'll talk about today is strictly true for Dirac neutrinos, for Majoranas. The story is different. And for simplicity of exposition, and only for that, I will assume that I will not make a distinction between mass and weak eigenstates. Okay, so I'll assume the mass eigenstates are also weak eigenstates. The changes are minor if this is not the case. And yeah, I'll not. Now, one of the issues that essentially put a stop to this field of looking for forces on matter from cosmic neutrinos is an Ogo theorem that was proven 40 years ago by Khabibov and Mayani and simultaneously by Langacker et al. And this theorem simply says that the force on an atom or the force on matter from the C nu B vanishes. And the argument is extremely simple. This is the interaction energy of an atom with the C nu B. If the density, the number density of neutrinos is constant, the force due to this interaction potential by Newton's law just vanishes because of the homogeneity for uniformity of the neutrino density. So uniformity of the C nu B of the cosmic neutrino density implies there is no force. And that sort of put a stop to, for the last 40 years, to attempt to look for forces. Recently, less than a year ago, we pointed out that it's possible to evade this theorem by considering interactions with the cosmic, of the cosmic neutrino background with the Earth. And that's what I want to briefly discuss now. To do that, it's convenient to introduce a familiar concept, the concept of the index of refraction, or more importantly, the quantity delta, which is the deviation of the index of refraction from unity. And that's the fractional change in the momentum of an object, of a, let's say, a neutrino as it enters, as it goes from the outside, from the vacuum inside the matter. And that fractional change in momentum by energy conservation is given by this formula, the neutrino mass times the potential divided by the neutrino momentum squared, which turns out to be a number in the neighborhood of 10 to minus 7, 10 to minus 8, depending on the material that we are using, on the whether we use a light or heavy material. So that's the, and as I said before, the interaction is repulsive or attractive depending on the neutrino type. And it's repulsive for electron neutrinos. Okay. Now, and this is the most important physical point now. So consider now neutrinos and antineutrinos. As neutrinos, as we said, neutrinos are repelled by matter. So neutrinos come from outside the Earth, let's say inside the Earth. Because the neutrinos are repelled by matter, when they come into matter, they'll be pushed up, okay? They'll slow down. Their component of velocity perpendicular will diminish, and so they'll be pushed up. The opposite happens for antineutrinos. When antineutrinos enter, they are pulled inwards, so their angle will be pushed downwards. Now, for neutrinos, essentially by continuity, you can argue that if you start scattering the neutrinos at smaller and smaller angles, eventually you will reach an angle. If the angle at which they scatter is sufficiently grazing, you'll reach a point where the neutrinos are repelled so much that they don't get inside matter. They just get bounced back. Now, this means that neutrinos that are falling at grazing incidence will slow down by the repulsion and spend a lot of time and, near the surface, and that will give rise to an excess of neutrinos around the surface of the Earth. Of course, to figure this out, you solve an undergraduate problem of Schrödinger's equation in the vacuum and then the constant potential to confirm this. But you can show that by solving this Schrödinger problem that there is an excess of neutrinos near the surface. To give you further intuition about how you can understand this in a one-dimensional context, first consider a one-dimensional problem where you have outside the Earth, the potential is zero, and then inside the Earth, the potential is some constant value. And this is a typical energy. Let's say the height of this potential is about 10 to the minus 14 electron volt. The typical energy of a neutrino is much higher, 10 to the minus 6. So a typical neutrino that enters will barely feel this potential. It has too high an energy. However, low energy neutrinos would bounce back from this potential. And in bouncing back, and that's an important thing, you will create what's called an evanescent wave, which is essentially the tail, the WKB tail of the wave function of the particle, of the neutrino in this case, if its energy is less than the potential. And this evanescent wave has a characteristic depth, which is very important. It turns out to be of the order of 3 meters for the problem at hand. And we'll come back to that in a moment. So that's what happens in one dimension. In one dimension, this is a tiny effect. A very small fraction of the neutrinos would have energy of less than 10 to minus 14 eV and bounce into the potential. There is the 10 minus, because the energy is so high, the average energy. However, in three dimensions, the counting changes a little bit. Here, in order to bounce, so here is the outside the Earth, and this is, on the right is inside the Earth. The left is outside. So a neutrino comes in. A typical neutrino that has the typical neutrino momentum, can still bounce off the surface as long as its incident angle is small enough. And you can compute what small enough means. The condition that a neutrino does not penetrate into the Earth is simply the condition that its kinetic energy perpendicular to the Earth has to be less, kinetic energy perpendicular to the Earth has to be less than the potential energy. And that condition implies that if the momentum, the transverse or the perpendicular momentum to the Earth is less than this expression, which turns out to be 1/3 meters, then those neutrinos will be slowed down and eventually will bounce back. Okay. Notice, this is an amusing observation, the momentum, the critical momentum below which you don't penetrate the Earth, scales like the square root of G Fermi. Typical weak interaction things, like the cross-section scales like G Fermi squared, so they are small. This happens to be, this is somewhat large results by neutrino standards because it goes like the square root of G Fermi. And it has the consequence that the fraction of neutrinos that are affected is a number which is not that small. It's of the order of 10 to the minus 4. This number of 10 to the minus 4 is just gotten very simply by finding the angle, the ratio between the critical momentum and the average momentum of the neutrinos, which is 10 to the minus 4. This means if you sit on the Earth, a fraction of 10 to the minus 4 of the solid angle, those that come at grazing incidence, will be reflected and slowed down and reflected, and they characterize the excess. So now here is a somewhat complicated figure. So this is the excess of neutrinos and the fractional excess of neutrinos minus antineutrinos on the surface of the Earth for various neutrino masses. This is the typical neutrino mass that we want to focus on, 0.15 eV. So the excess for such neutrinos is 5 × 10⁻⁴, which is significantly larger than the 10⁻⁹ that we expect from the primordial neutrino abundance from the Big Bang. So now this plot is somewhat function, a significant function of the neutrino mass. For heavier neutrino masses, the effect becomes very significant. But heavier neutrino masses I won't dwell on because they are not favored cosmologically. So I'll focus mostly on this. So for the typical neutrinos, we get an enhancement of about 10^4 to 10^5 over the primordial excess, over the primordial neutrino minus antineutrino excess. Okay. So if you want a more artistic picture of what I just showed you, if you consider the surface of the Earth, if you look at any portion of it, you expect over a height of 3 meters to find an enhancement of about 100,000 of the number of the fractional excess of neutrinos minus antineutrinos. This means observable effects that depend on the excess of neutrinos minus antineutrinos will be enhanced. Okay. So now, if you compute now the force on an object, now that there is a gradient, again, we can use Newton's law that the force is the gradient of the potential. Let's say on a 10 cubic centimeter tungsten, the force is still very small, 10⁻³ newtons. This is small. This is not going to be measured tomorrow. It may be several decades before we reach this. But it's better than what it was, which was zero, before we took these effects into account. Now, the question is, can we now manipulate the neutrinos ourselves? The Earth manipulates this by this optics exercise that I just outlined. Can we build specific configurations of matter that will improve the force that manipulate the neutrinos and improve the force that the neutrinos can exert on matter? And we'll end up proposing, so now I'll give you essentially the answer of what this configuration will be, and then I'll show you a few ingredients of how you get the answer. The answer will be that essentially what we will propose will be like a diffraction grating. The diffraction grating will look like a sea urchin. And these rods here, you can think of it as being the spines of the sea urchin. Okay? So it will be a sea urchin whose spine size is comparable to the body size. These spines will be rods. They'll be typically, we'll consider rods between 2 meters, then 10 meters, then 100 meters for various designs. The width of these rods will be on the order of 10 centimeters or so. These rods don't have to be fancy or manufactured. You can go in the middle of the night and pick them up by construction sites. Steel would work fine, and it's not that expensive. And 100 meter steel, people routinely know how to make for construction reasons such large steel structures. And steel would work pretty well. And what this configuration takes advantage of is the wave nature of neutrinos, in particular diffraction, as we will see. So, okay, so that's the answer. Now I'll tell you just a few details, and I may, okay, a few details. I may have to skip some. The way to deconstruct this sea urchin of rods, I'll tell you what one rod does. If you have one rod, let's say length L with W, let's say and you throw a plane wave, and then as the plane wave goes through the rod, the parts of the plane wave that are outside their rod don't get affected. Their phase evolves normally. The parts that go through the rod, they pick up an additional phase shift that is proportional to the degree to which the index of refraction is not one, okay? So if you now compute the field that such a configuration creates to the right of, then to do that, all you have to do is use, in fact, Huygens' principle from Huygens, it was a contemporary of Newton. Huygens was the person who said that the way waves propagate is by their waveform, you can consider each point on the waveform as producing secondary wavelets, which interfere and produce the next waveform, and then so on and so forth, and that's how waves propagate. And this intuition, which was brilliant, was eventually Kirchhoff and Fresnel, et cetera, the great man of optics, made into mathematical formula by using Maxwell's equation. And you, by summing all the wavelets that come from this configuration, including this crucial relative phase shift, you get a diffraction pattern. The diffraction pattern has a characteristic gradient. Notice the pattern changes on a scale of W, where W is the width. And the diffraction pattern first occurs at distance, which is the square of the width divided by the wavelength of the neutrino. This comes about because if you're very close to the rod, the various beams interfere destructively. But if you go far enough, then the path lengths don't vary, don't change much within one wavelength. So you get constructive interference here at a distance of W square over lambda. So that's when the best place to put a screen, if you wish, or to put a particle if you want to measure the force due to the gradient of the neutrinos, this right here would be a good spot because that's a region of high gradient of the density. And going further away doesn't help because diffraction will smear the density of the beam. So this is the optimal distance to put a test mass and see if there is any force on it. So that's the idea for a single rod. Of course, a single rod. In fact, I may go over this fast. These pictures show what I just told you with, you know, computer computations. So this is the diffraction pattern parallel to the rod. This is the diffraction pattern perpendicular to the rod that you see in all freshman textbooks, optics textbooks, except it looks a little more square because the aperture is square at the end. Okay. And this is what happens after you average momenta. The effect doesn't go away. So that summarizes. So what we learn from this exercise is that if you build such a construction with radius of W square over the wavelength, you put some, then you create, one thing. Why we went from the rod to this configuration, the neutrino, cosmic neutrino background doesn't come from the left. So it comes from all directions. So for that reason, you have to encompass many, many rods to take in to collect neutrinos coming from all directions. And so if you have such a structure whose radius is of order W square over lambda, and whose length turns out the best is if it's comparable to W square over lambda, then you have a good compound, what we call compound neutrino diffractor. Now the all important matter of choosing materials, I'm not going to say a lot other than to say that it's better to go to heavy materials. They have bigger weak charges. So for example, the index of refraction. And for some reason, in general, it's better to go to nu mu and nu tau neutrinos than nu is. They turn out, for heavy materials, to have bigger, to couple more strongly. So the best materials are the ones that you see here. Gold is one, but it's too expensive to make 100 meters of gold. Tungsten is not that expensive. Steel is not expensive, and it's already prefabricated, as I said, for construction purposes, so it wouldn't take too much to... And these things don't have to be finely engineered. The diffraction is pretty forgiving if you don't, if you are not very precise. And depleted uranium, I confess, when I first heard it, we heard this from our experimental colleague, Giorgio Grata. We thought he was joking, but anyway, depleted uranium is a very safe material, uranium-238. And in fact, it's very free. In fact, you don't even have to pay for transportation. If you want depleted uranium, you call up and they bring it to you, and they'll put it anywhere you want. And in fact, that's what Giorgio did for some of his experiments. They also, it turns out, use it to stabilize very big airplanes, the wings, of etc. It's very safe material. I don't think they say it to the passengers because of the words. Okay, so we have three. These are just sample proposals. We have a 2 meter, 10 meter, and 100 meter diffraction grating with, you know, widths and distances between the rods of the order of a few centimeters to, you know, 20 centimeters, 50 centimeters. And so these are the three proposals. And just for fun to estimate, we took the smallest to be with depleted uranium, then the medium to be tungsten, and the third iron, 100 meters. And we computed the neutrino minus antineutrino asymmetry. This is a color code. Light color means there is a nu bar minus nu excess. An antineutrino minus a neutrino excess. Dark means you have the opposite excess, and in between means that you have a gradient, and that gradient is what creates a force. Okay? Okay. I will skip. This essentially shows you, for the three proposals, what are how do the neutrino minus antineutrino excesses behave. And again, the main moral of the story is you get excess of the order of 10 to minus 3 for a small structure of 2 meters. Then it increases to half times, half a percent, and this is now more than a percent, fractional abundance or fractional excess of neutrinos minus antineutrinos. So this is, again, 6-7 orders of magnitude more than the primordial excess. This is just zeroing in on one thing, and on just the intermediate, the 10-meter proposal, and I don't think I'll want to show, to say much more about it. Okay, so that's important. I've said it a couple of times, but it's better to see it with a picture. So so this is the pattern of the gradients. And so if you put a sphere somewhere where there is, in a region where there is a big gradient, you will measure a force. Or instead of a single sphere, you can put a torsion balance. If you wish, two spheres made out of different materials, gold and aluminum, or some very different materials that would feel a different force, and therefore it would amount to a torque if you connect them. And it turns out, I mean, torsion balance experiments are very precise, so it's a convenient configuration. This is the force profile. If you have, this is for the 100 meter iron structure. This is the force profile around the center of the configuration. These arrows represent the force. You know, light color is big force, darker color is smaller force. And the main is conclusion to draw is that the forces that we are talking about on a 10 cubic centimeter tungsten is of the order of few times 10 to minus 28 newtons. Small. This is all, it's 1,000 times bigger than what the Earth gave us, but it is small. It's bigger than, you know, previous proposals, but it's small. You can do the same thing, and I won't spend any time on this, to the same diffractor, actually, that you build for neutrinos. You can also look for the QCD axion. I emphasize the QCD axion. And you find that the force from the QCD axion for the heavier range of allowed axion masses is 1,000 times bigger than the force due to neutrinos. So it's 10 to minus 25 newtons. So that's getting a little better, a little closer. But the axion is not, the QCD axion is not known to exist. So this would be a BSM search, not something that's guaranteed to be there. But you see that you explore a region of parameter space that is totally unexplored. And the only thing coming close to it is astrophysical constraints. Everything below that can be, this is the blue line is the QCD axion. The general pink area is the general axions. Okay, so the conclusion is, so I'm coming to the end, the concluding remarks. So the conclusion is, the Earth manipulates, without us doing anything, and significantly motivates the local cosmic neutrino background distribution. We can be clever, and there may be much cleverer ideas that we didn't have, to manipulate the neutrinos and increase their gradients and the density to give rise to bigger forces, but still small by today's standards of force measurements. So it sets a good challenging target for direct detection of the C-NUB. As I said, the targets that it sets are challenging, but we've been challenged several times before, and if there is a good motivation for challenging, experimentalists can do miracles. I mean, this is, for example, an idea of how well small-scale experiments evolved is the precision of clocks. We started in the 50s with a clock precision of 1 per century. You lose 1 second per century, so that was impressive. Now we reached 1 second per 10 times the lifetime of the universe. So several orders of magnitude. Of course, you know, it took 70 years, but science is, I mean, grand unified theories have been around for 50 years. You know, string theory has been around, depending on what is your starting point, 50 years or 40 years. So science takes time. So this is roughly, you know, 10 orders of magnitude of improvement in several decades. Similarly here, electric dipole moment measurements from 10 to minus 19 in the 60s to 10 to minus 29 now, 10 orders of magnitude in 60 years. So, and similarly, this is the WIMP cross-section. This is much faster because it was felt, part of the reason why it's faster, it has an extremely concrete physics motivation, what people believed was the best motivated dark matter candidate. So it triggered a lot of work between the 90s and the 2020s. So in 30 years, we reached, we expanded by 9 orders of magnitude. So why am I optimistic? I'm optimistic in the long run, and I don't know how many decades that will be. We are now working on ideas that we think may, if they work, they may be in my lifetime, which is an extremely strong statement. And so first is what I said. It's the golden age of small-scale experiments, as demonstrated by the last 3 plots. Second thing is that the C-NUB, the cosmic neutrino background, is part of the standard model of particle physics and standard model of cosmology. So it is known to exist. So looking for it, the motivation for looking for it, is similar to the motivation of looking for the cosmic microwave background radiation that has been dominating cosmology for the last 30, maybe 40 years. and the gravitational wave detection, which started in 1915, which was 100 years after Einstein predicted these phenomena. So in contrast to BSM searches, we understand part of the physics of the C-nu-B. And we can use it as a tool to understand more physics, either about the physics of neutrinos, are they Dirac, Majorana, how the right-handed sector, etc., and to look at the universe when it was 0.1 seconds old. So the level of motivation is significantly higher, and potentially the resources that can be devoted to this can be significantly higher because it's part of the standard, because we know where to look, we know what we are looking for, and we want to use it as a tool to learn more. The final point I want to emphasize with, I want to just illustrate with an anecdote, which has many repetitions in my life, but most recently, one of my best friends at Stanford is Aaron Kapitulnik, who I started doing physics, eating, drinking wine with since 1990. And so we have a very close relation. And in 91, I know, when I first heard that gravity from Peter Michelson, that gravity had only been measured down to a centimeter, I started bugging since 91, Aaron, go look for extra dimensions at the centimeter. Go look. Took him a while, but even before the proposal of large extra dimensions, he started, he seriously contemplated looking, and he started looking and spent 10 years of his life. And we know the result, he hasn't found anything. So, and that is pretty dramatic for a condensed matter experimentalist who produce, you know, annual results to show, etc. So anytime now I approach him for the last 10 years to tell him an idea, his reaction is he'll listen to me patiently and then ask, if I find nothing, is it important? And I say, well, yeah, it's good, but it's not as important as finding something. You'll settle him. Anyway, so he asked, this has happened many times. A few months ago, Mina and I went to his office, and we told him, we have an idea for you. Exactly the same discussion. If I find nothing, will it be important? We told him, if you find nothing, it may be even more important than if you don't. So now he's listening to us. And so I realize that I'm planting seeds whose shade I will not see. On the other hand, I think it's very important for, it will be great fun if humanity observes the cosmic neutrino background and learns about what the universe is like when it's a second old. Thank you.
We are a bit over time, but I think we can take a couple of questions.
Yes.
Could you make an horizontal gate only to amplify the ones that come already amplified by the Earth?
Say that, I'm sorry,
could
I cannot.
Could you make an horizontal grating only? Could you make an horizontal grating only?
A horizontal grating?
If instead of being a starfish, it was just on a plane.
Yes, you will lose some of the flux. You can. The reason, you know, if you want to get 4π acceptance, mm-hmm. That's what we drew. But you can take half a sphere. It doesn't have to be, you know, 4π coverage. So you will lose some solid angle if you make it horizontal. So you will suppress.
And it could be much bigger.
It could be bigger, but it could also have to be, if it's very, anything that's extremely long, will have very small acceptance angle, okay? It'll be the ratio of the, you know, width to the length squared. So you'll have a very small fraction of neutrinos collecting. But if it's bad, if it's, you know, bigger in all dimensions, you'll collect some things. But anyway, this was sort of, you know, obviously optimal, but you can do half a sphere for some experimentals. In fact, I mean, I didn't have time to mention. Several experimentals are talking to us, and the first thing that we hear from them, oh, I'll make half a sphere, it's much easier. Oh, there is another thing. It doesn't have to be built above ground. You can dig. Instead of having, you know, building these things which you can go and take from construction sites, so it's not a big deal, but you can dig in the ground. You can dig the same shape or maybe half that shape in the ground. As long as there is a density, you know, there is under-dense and over-dense, under, you know, spines, then you will do the same thing. So maybe digging. So experimentals are thinking about all kinds of things.
Next question is on Zoom. Go ahead.
There are a number of questions. Edward, why don't you start?
I just wondered how much different it is if you assume Myron and neutrinos.
They're very different. The first thing is, and we're working through this, one thing is, the coupling that I quoted is for Majorana neutrinos is suppressed by the velocity. Okay? So this means, for example, the critical angle, which went like the square root of the coupling, will be multiplied by the square root of the velocity of the neutrinos. The velocity of the neutrinos is 10 to minus 2. So you will lose a factor of 10 in the critical angle right there. And so both the gradient, so the gradient will be smaller, the force will be smaller. For Majorana neutrinos, we are thinking of different ideas that are still too preliminary to present. That we think they do may do much better, not just for Majoranas but also for Dirac. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Sure.
Let's take two more questions. One. Out there, and then one back.
Okay, I can go first. Two quick questions. The first one is, if the cross-section for like 100 meters of iron is significant, surely much of the cosmic neutrinos from the other side of the Earth must be reflected.
Yes.
Or something.
That's a very important point. Not only neutrinos and antineutrinos.
Right.
And we studied it. In detail. For simplicity, I only talked about things that come from the sky.
Okay.
In principle, you can worry about lots of things coming from underground, completely right. And in particular, you may even worry for antineutrinos that come from underground. And because they have the opposite delta, you know, they can be, in principle, totally scattered coming underground. And if they totally get reflected is the word, then they'll produce exactly the same phenomena with the opposite sign and cancel what I just told you. The important thing is that this doesn't happen. For example, because the Earth is approximately spherical, there is a tiny fraction that of the antineutrinos that can be reflected totally. And you can sort of see it. If you have a sphere and you have a ray that is totally reflected on the surface, then it will keep being reflected continuously. It will never leave. So a totally reflected internal rays can only originate in the sphere. They cannot originate outside. If they come from outside, then they leave. They don't keep. It's a great question.
Non è un po' caldo, Marlene, per tutti questi pipus.
Sì, sì, questo.
Perché?
Yes.
Il pone si sente fin qua,
eh?
Ok.
Sorry, maybe I can ask my second question really quickly. Yeah, there was some left-right anti-symmetry that you were talking about. If we assume standard model physics, even in early universe, if I understand correctly, why is there a better symmetry between the left and right hand neutrinos?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I'll repeat the question. If we assume standard model physics in early universe, why do we expect a better left-handed and right-handed symmetry?
We don't, in standard model, we don't have left-handed neutrino and right-handed neutrino symmetry.
Right, but I thought you said that these non-relativistic neutrinos, they have better left-handed and right-handed symmetry. Maybe I misunderstood.
No, I think it's true. The point is the following. If you have very fast, okay, only the left-handed neutrinos interact with weak interactions. Right-handed neutrinos have no gauge interactions with the standard model. So they are not produced in the early universe, okay? Similarly, when there is radioactivity, you produce neutrinos, it's left-handed neutrinos. Not right-handed. However, in the universe, because the universe is expanding, the neutrinos are slowly losing momentum as the universe expands. When they become non-relativistic, as they expand, the neutrinos...
Okay, last chance. You didn't mention ultra-relativistic neutrinos, such as an ice cube. Have an effect on your plans and ideas. Ultra-relativistic neutrinos, such as an ice cube.
Such as what?
An ice cube.
Yes.
Is there an effect of them on the Earth?
No, because they are very relativistic. You see, the index of refraction goes like the mass times the potential divided by the square of the momentum. For relativistic particles, it goes like the potential over the momentum. So for ultra-relativistic, the momentum is so high that the index of refraction, the difference of the index of refraction from unity is tiny. So these effects are very suppressed.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Coffee break and thanks again for
Okay.